So let's begin by chanting Refuge in Bodhicitta, page 8 in English. In Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Spiritual Community, we go for refuge until fully enlightened. By the power of all six perfections, from generosity to new wisdom, and all beings may realize Buddhahood. So Lama Surya Das asked if I would speak about sky gazing, and you can thank the compassion of the Kariyats that we are not going outside. They said, no, you cannot possibly take these people outside in this heat. And you can also blame them because now you get to listen to me instead. And you get to listen to a lot more than I expected, because when I went back to my hut after Lama Surya's talk this morning, I kind of had a vague outline of what seemed appropriate to talk about, and then it felt important to provide a context. So I sat down to provide a little bit of context of where sky gazing fits in our tradition and in the evolution of Buddhism, and there was some download. If I wanted to up-level beyond appropriateness, I would call it a mind turmer, but something happened anyway, so you are the victims hereof. What I was hoping to do was, as I said, provide a context, and to do that, I thought the way to do that would be to provide a very brief overview of the evolution of Buddhist practices and insights and how they culminate in our tradition and the practices we're doing. And to do that, I also need to spend a little time on to understand sky gazing. We also need to spend a little time on the ancient classic practice of wise attention. Okay. So, here in less than 20 minutes, hopefully, is 2,500 years of Buddhist evolution. So, and you thought it couldn't be done. So many of us here actually had our start in the Theravadin tradition, the tradition of the elders, sometimes called Hinayana, and the practices there, of which the central meditation is Vipassana, or insight practice. If we look further back at the time of the Buddha and even before, as best we can tell, it seems that the primary practices at that time were primarily concentrative practices. Which developed samadhis, or the practices which we know as the jhanas, and which, as you know, were the first meditative practices that the Buddha mastered. However, the innovation, the Buddha's innovation in meditation, which clearly came out of his own extraordinarily investigative turn of mind, his absolute determination to plumb the depths of reality as far as anyone could. The product of that was the practice of Vipassana, which many of us have done here, which essentially is a microscopic inner examination of experience and mind, and which fosters a wide panorama of experiences and insights, of which we could spend, and many people have spent, many talks just describing the various kinds of insight that arise, the so-called experiences of insight. But we can just focus on some that are particularly key, and some of the core insights are the recognition and investigation of the so-called three marks of existence, anicca, dukkha, anatta, or dukkha being the experience of the recognition that of what's badly translated as suffering, much more appropriately rendered as a recognition of the unsatisfactoriness of phenomena and phenomenal existence, and the recognition that all phenomena, by virtue of the second mark of existence, that they change, they're never stable, that None of them can be relied on. None of them provide a fully satisfying foundation or rationale for living. And none of them bring complete satisfaction, which in contemporary language we might say that this is the good news is nothing is ever going to make you fully happy. No thing is ever going to make you fully happy. Or having it all is not enough. And finally, the recognition of anatta, loosely translated as no self, the recognition that it's extraordinary the extent to which we usually, prior to taking up contemplative practices, live our lives with no close inspection of what we assume to be our, quote, self. And what we find when we investigate is that we have operated our entire life out of an unexamined presupposition that there is this concrete, abiding, permanent self or essence to us. And what in meditation reveals, as all of you have recognized to varying degrees, is that when we look closely, what we have presumed to be an unchanging self turns out to be constituted of a flux of experience. So that the separate self sense turns out in a very fundamental way to be illusory. And as the mind is investigated very deeply, it culminates in a kind of deconstruction of the cognitive functioning, or cognitive apparatus of the mind, which deconstructs and reveals or unveils the underlying reality behind the so-called unconditioned or nirvana. And these insights are not only informative, not only revelatory, but liberating, or in the language of religious studies, soteriological. That is, they have freeing or liberating capacity. And the Theravadin ideal, and each Buddhist jhana or tradition has an ideal as the kind of ideal archetype, that archetype to which which it holds out as the ideal to which we are moving, and which we ultimately discover is actually a representation of who and what we really are. The Theravadin ideal is the arahat, the one who has overcome craving and defilements and is able to rest in the peace of nirvana. Okay, so that's just an overview of some of the practices and insights that result out of the first jhana. Second jhana, Mahayana, or the great vehicle as it likes to call itself, is marked by several evolutionary progressions. First, a deeper investigation of the nature of reality, and discovering that what applied to the self, that is, that what was assumed to be some concrete clearly identifiable object, that insight also applies to all objects, all phenomena. That all objects, all phenomena, everything, every manifest entity, when examined closely, is found to be, and here we run into the difficulties of language, classically described as shunyata, usually translated inadequately, but any translation is inadequate as empty. I remember in the early days when I first started studying with Lama Surya, I asked him about shunyata, and his response was, "Ah, shunyata is a tough nut to crack." So, just because Surya couldn't do it, but actually, of course, Yeah, it's a very tough nut. And the reason it's tough is that it is pointing to the nature of reality as being beyond our concepts. And the way I would define shunyata is that I would say that shunyata is the recognition that all phenomena are transconceptual. That is, that they go beyond, they cannot be adequately grasped by any concept. So our concepts imply something about reality that isn't so. They imply there's an essence or a core to phenomena that isn't really there. What we actually experience is just a field of raw experience, which our concepts divide into separate entities. And then once we've divided out or carved out a bell, then we assume there is something about this entity, namely bellness, that is distinct about it. But what we find when we investigate is that that assumption that there is some essence or core is really something that is imputed to the object by the mind, by its concepts. Now, this seems very abstract and abstruse, but it has some extremely important implications. And the important implication, and the crucial thing to recognize, both about shunyata and about the way the mind works, which is extraordinarily important, is that we think we respond to phenomena. Actually, we don't respond to phenomena per se, we respond to our concepts and ideas about phenomena. Okay. So the more deeply we are able to recognize shunyata, the more fully we are able to experience things, just the experience, just the sound, prior to the conceptual overlay and overload that goes on top of it. To that extent, we are free of our conditioned automatic responses. By experiencing things so closely that we're able to recognize shunyata and relate to the immediate experience, to that extent we undercut our condition and automaticities and recognize that we have given everything all the meaning it has for us. In other words, this enables us to become free of our conditioning and to become choiceful in our responses. So you can begin to see this is an extraordinarily important insight, and it's said in the Mahayana and Vajrayana traditions that to see fully into shunyata is to be liberated. So now we have four marks of existence. We have dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness. We have anicca, or change. We have anatta, or no self. And we have shunyata, the transparency or transconceptuality of phenomena. And putting this in simple terms, I want to do a riff on something that Wes Nisker initially gave on the first three, his interpretation of first three marks, and I want to add a fourth. So we've got unsatisfactoriness, we've got all things change, we've got absence of enduring concrete self, and we've got emptiness or shunyata. So this can be translated as life's tough. It'll put you through some changes. But don't take it personally, because nothing means anything. Okay. And in the contemporary West, we know the Mahayana best probably as Zen, and its core practice is Shikantaza, which consists, about the sole instruction for Shikantaza is just sit. Or should I have this posture? Just sit. Should I work with my thoughts? Just sit. Should I cultivate love? Just sit. And it's a very profound, intriguing thing to take as your instruction to do what you are already doing. It undercuts all the endless mental projects that the mind usually creates and drops us right into this moment. Now, the third major innovation of Mahayana was its elevation of compassion. And this resulted, quite understandably, in a new archetype or ideal, namely the Bodhisattva, the person who sought liberation, but moved by compassion, no longer sought it for themselves alone, but rather for all beings. So this was the Bodhisattva. And then the third jhana is our own enormously rich and complex tradition of Vajrayana, which I won't really pretend to encompass here, but I just want to point to a few themes which continue the evolutionary thread we've been following. And so aspects of Vajrayana developed an even more subtle understanding of Shunyata and corresponding philosophies. Shentong and Prasangika, Madhyamaka philosophies, which we certainly don't need to go into, even if I was capable of doing so. But very subtle and nuanced understandings of Shunyata. And also developed an enormous array of practices, subtle level practices, practices working with the subtle phenomena of mind, visualization practices. Sometimes said that Zen is essential Buddhism and Vajrayana is complete Buddhism. Because Vajrayana offers not only this liberation, but this extraordinary panorama of practices to cultivate all varieties of beneficial qualities, and says is able to do so via these practices in more skillful and speedy ways. And at the heart of many of these practices, the visualization practices, we find the visualization of an identification with archetypal figures. We have Guru Rinpoche behind us, Vajrasattva, Tara. And the idea is, remember yesterday we talked about the fact that when we are simply aware of something that arises in the mind, it has no power over us. But when we identify with it, we assume it to be reality and it becomes effectively our reality and conditions us. Well, Vajrayana uses that principle of mind with extraordinary profundity and skillfulness. Look at, well, what are the most profound things one could possibly identify with? What are the most beneficial mental objects one could create and identify with? Knowing that what we identify with becomes our reality and cultivates the qualities, corresponding qualities. So, by creating a family of visualization practices, each with a particular archetypal deity symbolizing these qualities, we cultivate these qualities. Now, this in itself is an evolution of old yogic practices. If you look at the classic yoga sutras of Patanjali, you find if you wanted to, you'd find a way of developing various qualities, and it says, if you to develop the strength of an elephant, meditate on an elephant. Well, there's something to that. And Vajrayana has these infinitely more sophisticated practices representing not just physical strength, but the most refined spiritual qualities. Here's a really important thing to know about the mind. What you focus on, what you attend to, you become. So the visualization practices make use of that mental principle. And they evolve through various stages. For example, many of us here have done the Vajrasattva practice. Vajrasattva, the archetype of purity, spiritual purity. And what we do is we visualize or create an image of Vajrasattva, and then we work with that in various ways, and eventually we identify with it. We merge with Vajrasattva, which is an identification with. And at first, Vajrasattva is just a nice visual image that we're creating. And then as you do the practice, as the you become imbued with the qualities of Vajrasattva, it becomes apparent, one's own self-image begins to shift in the direction of Vajrasattva. That is, one begins to conceive of oneself as more and more like Vajrasattva. Recognizing, oh yes, I am purifying, I am getting a little cleaner, I am getting clearer, and beginning to embody or identify or own those qualities as oneself. And then as you see more deeply into shunyata or emptiness or an anatta, one recognizes that one's own identity, that what one had assumed to be Roger or Drew or Nicole or whoever you have assumed yourself to be, mistakenly, actually has no more reality or substantiality than the image of Vajrasattva. That, yes, the Vajrasattva is just an image, just a mental construct, is empty, is anatta, but so is what you assumed yourself to be. And then things start to get extremely interesting. Because then you realize that who you thought you were is no more real than Vajrasattva. Or put it another way, Vajrasattva is just as real an identity for you as who you thought you were is. And then you begin to realize, oh my. Vajrasattva is actually a far more accurate representation of who I am than Roger or Drew or Nicole or Colleen. Oh. And then you realize Vajrasattva is actually an exquisite representation of your higher potentials and who you really are. At that stage, your self-image has undergone a very dramatic transformation. And you realize that you've spent your entire life suffering from a case of mistaken identity. Really? It's true. So the Vajrayana aims not only to free oneself from the world and its conditioning and kleshas and defilements, not only to bring that same liberation to all beings, but also to cultivate all the possibilities of incarnation and to play effectively in samsara, to recognize, to see that this is actually a pure realm, to cultivate, to develop pure vision so that one recognizes that what we've taken to be the mundane reality is not separate from nirvana, is rather an expression of the absolute, is the manifestation, is the play of the absolute. And so the archetype, the ideal archetype of Vajrayana is the siddha, one who liberates, self-liberates, and cultivates and aims for the liberation of all, but also recognizes this as a sacred realm, as a pure realm, as all beings, as sacred beings, as dakas and dakinis, and plays in the manifest realm. Yes, there is suffering. Yes, there is unsatisfactoriness if one thinks that the one is a solid, separate ego and one's satisfaction must come from something outside oneself. But beyond that, there is the possibility of recognizing one's true nature and recognizing its inherent satisfactoriness and fullness and bliss and playing, expressing that in the world. Playing in the world. It's an exquisite vision. This is pure vision. And one of the yogic precepts is to hold pure vision as continuously as one possibly can. Then we come to Dzogchen. And here our central practice is Trekchen. Now all Buddhist wisdom practices aim to point us towards reality or the absolute, to point us towards it, to help us understand it, and ultimately to unveil it, to help us recognize it. And this reality is, of course, shunyata, empty, beyond concepts. Just as with all manifest phenomena, so too is the absolute shunyata. And we can, so it's here we are running, of course, into the difficulties of language, but we will play as best we can. So we can know this absolute reality as pure awareness, or pure presence, or Rigpa, and we can come to recognize that this is. And here I'm using spatial metaphors. You have to use something. That Rigpa is always already present. That Rigpa is always already behind the mind or beneath it or pervading it. And here I want to draw the distinction that Dzogchen makes between the mind or the psyche, the cognitive attentional apparatus, which it calls sem, and Rigpa, pure awareness. And for those of you with just to put it in technical language for those of you who have that kind of background, Rigpa is ontologically prior to mind and manifestation. So if this is so, if Rigpa is ever-present, omnipresent, not in the sense of being infinite and eternal, not in the sense of lasting a long time, or being, let me try that again, not in the sense of being infinite as in very big, but being transpatial, not in the sense of eternal, in the sense of being long-lasting or lasting forever, but being transtemporal. So if, since Dzogchen recognizes the Rigpa is omnipresent, always already present, but usually veiled by mental activities, then the extraordinary, beautiful recognition of Dzogchen is that we don't have to go through the mental gymnastics. Wonderful and beneficial as they are. Rather, we can simply allow the mind, sem, to come to rest. The obscurations dissolve and Rigpa is unveiled. And the exquisite beauty and simplicity of Trakchit is that we bring the mind to rest not by working with it, not by deliberately changing it, not by cultivating positive qualities to counteract the negative ones, all of which only at a very subtle level only create further agitation. But rather, we bring the mind to rest by simply allowing it to be exactly as it is. And when we allow the mind to be as it is, when we can accept our experience in this moment, then there is no energy that is being added to sem, to the mental the mind is not being activated in any way. And it simply subsides and dissolves and allows us first to glimpse, and then to more continuously recognize the pure awareness which was always already present. And as we allow the mind to come to rest, the machinery creating a separate self-sense, creating the sense of a Roger or a Drew or a whoever you think you are, dissolves. And what is left? What is left if the separate self-sense is dissolved, if the mental activity and content is dissolved? Well, only two, quotes, things. One is awareness, and the other is the universe. And the experience is that the universe is meditating. What else is there to meditate? And what is the universe aware of? Well, the universe. And in our tradition, we personify this, saying that Kuntizampo is aware of Kuntizampo. There's no one else around. What else could Kuntizampo be aware of? And so the ideal archetype in our tradition of Dzogchen is the Rigdon or Vidyadhara, who's one who maintains continuous awareness of Rigpa. Or more precisely, one in whom Rigpa is continuously aware of himself, itself. Or there was a wonderful interchange with Nyosho Kempo in Harvard, where Lama Suryadas took him to give a talk. And someone asked Nyosho Kempo, does Your Holiness enjoy the bliss of Rigpa continuously? To which Nyosho Kempo responded, Rigpa enjoys itself without Nyosho Kempo. So, okay. So believe it or not, all that was for a purpose. This is leading us towards a practice. And we need to have one more thing for our context here, and that is the venerable classic practice of wise attention. This is a relative practice. It's not an absolute practice. It's a practice working with sim, or the mind, in which we focus on those on... We choose to focus on positive phenomena. That is, we choose very carefully our attention, where we put our attention. And we try not to give our attention to objects and phenomena which cultivate negative feelings. Now, this doesn't mean we avoid suffering, or avoid angry people, but we don't dwell on those, we don't dwell on, indulge in angry thoughts or fantasies. And for example, our culture some people in our culture pay enormous attention to what we put in our mouths, but not a lot of attention to what we put in our minds. And if you watch, you can imagine, given the fact the average American watches 4 hours of television a day, you can imagine what that does to the mind, and there's research backing that up. You know, people who watch a lot of television are more angry, more paranoid. What a surprise! You know? So wise attention is the skillful practice of using the fact that the mind takes on the qualities of what we attend to. Remember, what we attend to, we tend to become. Wise attention makes use of that to, for example, focus, for example, to cultivate love. You might focus on an image or memory of, say, His Holiness the Dalai Lama or Lama Suryadas. Okay? Knowing that the mind will cultivate these qualities. And this can be very, very powerful. There was a time quite some years ago when I had this quite wonderful, profound altered state that endured for months, was ecstatic, blissful, quite wonderful. And then my wife and I went on vacation to Hawaii, and we went into this condominium we were renting. And being the bibliomaniac I am, I saw the bookshelf and immediately started pouring through the bookshelf and picked up these books, which were trash. But that didn't stop me reading them, so I stood there literally for 20 minutes reading the sex and violence. Like, I put it down. The state had disappeared. 2 months in this ecstatic, blissful state, 20 minutes just filling my mind with that stuff, it was gone and didn't come back. So this is powerful stuff, what we attend to. Okay, so what qualities of mind are we trying to cultivate in Trekchit, in our sky gazing? Well, we're trying to cultivate, to the extent we're cultivating, and here it gets interesting, the qualities that are qualities that reflect the nature of mind itself, qualities that reflect Rigpa. So to do that, it would make sense to take an object, something that has qualities reminiscent of Rigpa. Well, what would that be? Well, the sky. Take a look at it sometime. It's open, clear, boundless, luminous, empty, spacious, unchanging. It has clouds that go through it, but the clouds don't change it in any way. It's immovable. It's unaffected by the clouds. It's unperturbed. It's ungraspable. We can't feel it, touch it. And that is a pointer towards the nature of mind. And it seems that, or as I understand anyway, it seems easiest to awaken to an aspect of reality when the mind is most closely or aligned with or reflective of or congruent with that aspect of reality. So to awaken to realize Rigpa, we take as the object which is most reminiscent, evocative, similar to, analogous to Rigpa. And that object, the sky, is essentially, in many ways, beyond anything we can say or describe or about it or any quality. So we do the practice by finding a comfortable seat. We look into the sky, perhaps raising the eyes somewhat, adopting a soft focus, just allowing the mind, allowing the eyes to look into the sky without particular focus of any kind. We relax. We release any effort, any attempt to change our experience or to control the mind in any way. And with that, dissolve struggle and strain. And we allow all things to be exactly as they are. We allow the mind to be just as it is. And what we discover is that in every moment of experience, there is only one thing that is common to every single moment of experience, and that's awareness. Objects change, the mind changes, but awareness is. Prior to all objects, unchanged by all objects, untouched by all objects, untouchable by all objects. Beyond any concept, shunyata, but we can use words to point to the fact that it is this vast, open, boundless, spacious awareness. Encompassing all the senses and the mind. So we sit and recognize that our awareness is not in our body, rather our body and mind are in our awareness. So what I'd like to do now is do a brief sitting, and again, due to the compassion of the Kariyats, it'll be inside rather than outside, but we can do the same practice, just releasing, except we won't have the sky as our object, But I want to just do this and give you just a couple of little pointers or tricks that are useful. Just one more thing to say, that of course, as Lama Suri has pointed out, there's only one thing to realize, but there are depths of that realization. The first initial glimpses, then continuing stabilization, and also an increasingly clear recognition. That is, the obscurations of, there are obscurations of mind at varying degrees going from gross to increasingly subtle. Well, the gross activity of mind settles at first, but there's usually very subtle mental activity going on. And so we glimpse Rigpa, but usually it's still partially obscured by the subtle obscurations. And as we practice, as we continue our sittings, then gradually the settling of mind increases and the obscurations become thinner and thinner. Okay? Now, one can also use certain tricks to cut through. Trekchard often translated as cut through. Cut through those obscurations. And some of those tricks for cutting through include one is just as you're sitting gazing into the sky, just very rapidly moving the eyes backward and forward, left, right, left, right, left, right. And there's something about that which just cuts through mental activity. Another thing is a startle. Several schools of Zen use a startle as a means of breaking through sin into the unconditioned. If you've read Zen stories, you'll read these stories of Zen masters kind of haunting or stalking advanced students, and just to the right moment, coming up behind them and yelling as loud as they can into their ear. And the mind goes, oh. The mind stops. And in that stopping, is in that moment, there's the recognition of awareness, of Rigpa. Well, we do that, except we also startle ourselves. We do it by yelling, pet. And if you yell, pet, suddenly, sharply, it produces a startle response which stops the mental activity and literally cuts through the obscurations. And so you yell, pet! And that moment, just look, there's an instant of clarity, luminosity. It's like, and then you may be able to watch the subtle obscurations come back and things get a little more fuzzy. Or maybe they won't, and if they don't, please come and tell us. Okay, so I want to do just a brief sitting, because that's all we have time for. I just want to use a couple of tricks, these and other tricks, and give you a taste of their possibilities. Okay, so. Okay, relax. Allow yourself to take some long exhalations, breathing, letting the air fall out, and relaxing and releasing as you do so. And now, as you exhale, imagine your breath going out to the farthest reaches of the universe and your awareness going out and expanding with it. So on the exhalation, imagine the breath going out, expanding out to infinity, and your awareness follows. Good. And just relax with awareness. That's the essence of this practice. Notice in this moment, there is awareness. And now notice your experience, particularly that sense of presence. And try flicking your eyes to left and right several times quickly. And then pay close attention. That's it. There with that awareness. And if you find yourself feeling sleepy, raise your gaze. That's energizing. If you find yourself agitated, lower the gaze a little. That's calming. And now pay really close attention to the experience when mental activity stops. Ah! Now, look. Clear, luminous awareness. There's just awareness. So would anyone like to comment or ask questions?
Just talk close? Okay. Thank you. That was really an exceptionally clarifying talk. Thank you.
Great.
There was one spot where I feel like I kind of lost, it was a kind of the magic happens moment, which is I can experience that, like with the pet, that was a really effective, the dropping, the clarity. But as I heard you explain it, I understood it to be that the mind, the sem-mind stops. But it seems to me the sem-mind is still producing. I mean, there's still visual, things are still arising in the sem-mind. So I'm not quite sure that one process, when you say that mind comes to rest, but it's still interpreting, it's still laying on all of its scripts, right?
Well, usually. But there is the possibility for that to stop. No?
Yeah, so there's this sort of level of deconstruction where things occasionally have like no shape or meaning. But that lasts very briefly for me. I mean, that's not how I'd live my life.
Yeah.
I would be able to find my keys. So it seems to me that maybe I'm misunderstanding when you say mind stops or drops away. I think of mind as even that, like the little atoms come in and then they're perceived and then they're turned into blue and then blue is turned into Tonka. But that still keeps happening.
Yeah. Yes. That kind of precognitive level of mental activity continues. But the more secondary level of kind of conceptualization and so forth.
Okay. Yeah. That's a Tonka. I like that Tonka.
Oh yes. Now I'm really aware. Boy, I really see. Yes. Yes. That's it. I find that stuff.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
How does this relate to the clear light practice? When I was at Joshua Tree, the clear light was, we were doing sky gazing. There was one point when I was going into the dining hall and I looked up and I just was making that connection. I mean, when I'm driving down the road after the retreat for a while, just being in a certain circumstances was making that connection for me. Is my sem-mind just resting? And is that the connection that I'm making?
I got a little lost there, but there is a distinct practice, one of the six yogas of Naropa, which is clear light practice. But that's a distinct practice from this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I have a little bit of a question about word usage, I guess. Since I was raised Catholic, the use of ever-present omnipresence of Rigpa has rings a bell in me of, well, that's God.
Well, I like Stephen Mitchell's definition of God as, let's see if I can pull it up. God is a word which points to the utterly ineffable and incomprehensible. If you find that This is a conversation which could get way more complex than we want to, but because if the term God probably has more conceptual historical baggage than almost any term, along with ego and self and a few others.
Yeah.
But if you were to start talking about the Christian Godhead, the unmanifest abyss, rather than some archetypal personhood, then things would get very interesting in their comparison.
Well, or Christ consciousness, I guess you might say.
lots of ways to play with these things, but
right.
Much better for us to realize them for ourselves.
Right. Yeah. I do have one other thought, though. There's a quote upstairs of Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, and he says, "You realize thoughts as unborn, non-abiding, and unceasing." And I thought that was the idea of thoughts as unborn was very profound for me. Because when I think of birth, I think of a beginning, a gestation, and then an emergence. And there's something about it being unborn that alters that whole thing.
Yes, and when we begin to see into shunyata, we begin to recognize that words that if there are no concrete essences of phenomena, then actually nothing arises. But this gets way too abstruse, so probably better we come to an end.
Thank you.
Stop the words, and let me encourage you to just enjoy the sky gazing practice, to feel free to use these adjuncts to practice, the PET, the flicking the eyes, raising, lowering, see what works for you. Following the breath to infinity, not as primary, something to do often, but as best serves your practice.